George Copeland left the theater at around 11 p.m. when the play ended. He and many of the prominent Denver men he was visiting had attended the Ziegfeld Follies of 1910, a sort of variety-slash-vaudeville-slash-Broadway show that was popular at the time. It only took him about 15 minutes before Copeland was back at his hotel, the Brown Palace, where he ambled up to a golden marble bar and ordered a gin Ricky. The bar was relatively crowded. It usually was just after the theater let out, but Copeland easily found a spot beside James Atkinson, a Colorado Springs contractor who wanted a drink before hopping on the train back home. Only moments after ordering his cocktail, Copeland's conversation with Atkinson was interrupted by two men quarreling just behind them. Their argument was growing louder when the largest of the two hauled off and punched the other in the jaw. As soon as the guy hit the floor, Atkinson realized this was not the place to be. He turned to Copeland. "Let's get out. There's going to be a fight," he said. Copeland agreed, sensing the hostility in the air, but before he had the chance to move, bullets began to fly. There were two quick shots as bar patrons scrambled for safety. One bullet sailed into the man's intended target, but the second missed and hit Copeland, standing directly behind him. The gunman paused, then fired three more times, hitting Copeland once more, then his poor white-haired friend Atkinson. The bullet struck above his left knee and shattered his femur. The fifth and final bullet missed Atkinson and Copeland and returned to the original target. Copeland lay bleeding on the barroom floor until bystanders helped him over to an anteroom. He had been shot in the right hip and the left leg below the knee, and his femoral artery was severed. All three victims were rushed to St. Luke's Hospital, but only one of them would leave alive. The following day, March 25th, 1911, Denver newspapers exploded with the news. Murders at the Brown Palace Hotel. This is the historical true crime podcast, Old Blood, and I'm your host, Elise. They called her Sassy because she was, but she was born as Isabel Patterson in 1880, either in Arkansas or Michigan, though she was raised in St. Louis. When she turned 20, Isabel married a traveling shoes salesman named John Folk. He turned out to be an alcoholic and physically abusive, so they separated after 6 years of marriage. By 1906, Isabel Patterson Folk was regarded as one of the most beautiful women in St. Louis, where she attracted the attention of the city's most prominent men. Sassy was a social butterfly, as they called her, always eager for the spotlight and happiest while socializing. One of Sassy's suitors was the aeronaut Sylvester von Fuhl, who was also from a well-known St. Louis family, and allegedly related to the city's founders. It's rumored that he and Isabel attended school together back in St. Louis as kids, but this is unconfirmed. Tony, as those whom he liked were allowed to call him, used to work for the Anheuser-Busch Brewing Company, but he became famous as an aeronaut after he discovered ballooning as a hobby in 1908. He learned quickly and became leader of various aeronaut clubs. In 1910, Tony von Fuhl took the vaudeville actress Gertrude Hoffman up with him in his balloon, as he would also do with Eva Tangway, star of the Ziegfeld Follies. She was famous for her song, "I Don't Care," which Hoffman sang as the two ascended the skies in his balloon. Von Fuhl was a daredevil. It was why he enjoyed the hobby to begin with, and he faced numerous near-death experiences. By 1911, von Pfuhl had participated in the 1909 International and logged over 50 flights. He was the dashing adventurer that the women of St. Louis swooned for. And in 1907, Sylvester von Pfuhl was seeing the beautiful and newly divorced Isabel Patterson Folk. Despite the intensity of their relationship, Isabel ultimately decided to marry another man, a man from Denver named John Springer, in April of 1907. Springer was by this time a leading figure in Denver, and certainly had enough money to support his new socialite wife, even purchasing a mansion about 30 miles south of Denver and naming it Castle Isabel. Social creature that she was, she often preferred to stay in the city, so John Springer also rented rooms for her at Denver's finest hotel, the Brown Palace. Built in 1892, the triangular-shaped building was one of America's first fireproof structures, as well as being one of the nation's first atrium-style hotels. Its stained glass ceiling soared over the hotel's 9 floors. It's no surprise that the hotel hosted a fleet of presidents, socialites, foreign dignitaries, crime bosses, and later, the Beatles. This was exactly the type of scene Sassy wished to be in, and Denver welcomed their beautiful new socialite with open arms. Her husband, John Wallace Springer, was the son of an attorney and the nephew of a congressman. He spent about a decade practicing law and represented his district in the Illinois House of Representatives in 1891. He moved to Texas, then to Denver in 1896. Here, he worked on behalf of William McKinley's presidential campaign. After buying and running several Denver businesses, he decided to run for mayor in 1904 against Robert Speer, and then lost in what is now considered the state's most corrupt election. Many people in Denver knew and liked Springer, but Mayor Speer bested him with about 10,000 phony votes. When his friends endorsed him as a vice presidential candidate at the 1904 Republican convention, he honestly believed he was headed for the White House with Roosevelt. He wasn't. He was sent packing back to Denver. When President Roosevelt visited the Brown Palace the following year, Springer was not even invited to the banquet. But Springer's ego was extraordinarily resilient, so he kept trying, and by 1916 his name was tossed around as a possible candidate for the U.S. Senate. The Republican Party had their eye on someone else, though, and this too fell through. Dick Crack, Denver historian and author of Murder at the Brown Palace, quoted a newspaper who commented, "Springer is going up like a rocket just now, or thinks he is, but he will come down like a stick this fall. He thought he was going to run for the vice presidency with Roosevelt, but he ran for mayor instead, and did not run very fast either." Another noticed, "Few people seem to take John W. Springer seriously. There's nothing serious about a joke." John Springer, however, was determined to prove that he was serious. He was married once before and had a daughter, Annie, whom he had to raise alone after his wife Eliza died of tuberculosis in 1904. And then, in 1907, things began to start looking up for him when he fell in love with and married the beautiful Isabel, 27 years old. He, 47. She often went on business trips with him to New York City, and they loved to visit California together. Back home, Denver residents recalled seeing the new Mrs. Springer in their red brick mansion on Washington Street. She used to come out in the thinnest of negligees and stand out on the stoop and give orders to the servants. End quote. The strange couple was a source of gossip even before the murders at the Brown Palace. Unbeknownst to Springer, Isabel had not ceased contact with her aeronaut lover, Tony Von Fool. The earliest letter is dated to January 31st, 1911. "Dearest love," she wrote to him, "I can hardly bear to be away from you. I miss you so much. You are the only one I love in the world. Isabel." She wanted Tony to visit her in Denver, but he was busy with business in Kansas City, so she resorted to a string of love letters in which she urged him to stay on the ground. She feared for his safety while up in the air and chided him for not writing as often. After not hearing from him for 3 days, Sassy wrote, "If I don't get a letter or some word from you within the next 24 hours, I will take the first train to Kansas City so my little sweetheart can hold me in his arms." Her husband Springer was waiting in the next room as she finished her letter so that the two could go to dinner. Isabel Springer suffered several various medical issues in the spring of that year, which she related to Von Fool in the letters. "John, brother, and the rest of them are sitting in another room worrying themselves to death about my condition. But, dear, you are the only one I am interested in, and if they only knew." Papers reported that she underwent an appendectomy, but Dick Crack thinks this was just a cover-up for a more personal issue she was having. She ended her letter, "Well, dear, if I don't come out of this and if I never see you again, just remember that you are the only one I ever loved." She continued to beg him to visit her in Denver and tried to convince her husband that she needed a trip to Hot Springs, Arkansas, where she would be able to see Von Fool. In April of 1911, she wrote to "My Darling," "Just a little note tonight to let you know your little sweetheart is thinking of you. John is in the next room and likely to come in at any minute, so you know I must hurry. Oh, how I wish you were here tonight to tuck me in my little bed and kiss me goodnight. I have been sick ever since I left St. Louis, and you can't imagine how much I have longed for you, sweetheart." Just after her operation, she wrote to him that it was successful. "Yesterday, the doctor took out the stitches, and, oh, sweetheart, how it did hurt. I didn't cry because I knew you would call me a baby. I'm sending you a piece of one of the stitches which the doctor took out today. This is the longest one I could find, and I told the nurse to be sure and save it for me because I wanted to send it away. She laughed at me, but I knew you would like to have it. I will soon be out of the hospital, and then I will tell John that a trip will be a good thing for me. I am sure he will let me go to Hot Springs, and then you can hold me in your arms once more and make me the happiest woman in the world. With all the love in the world, and hoping to be with you soon, I am yours forever, Isabel." It was not just Isabel and Tony, though. It wasn't even just Isabel, Tony, and John Springer, for she had been introduced to a third man in her life back in March. Harold Francis Henwood arrived in Denver at the end of 1910. He came from a wealthy family and was even born in Naples while his parents were vacationing in Italy. Frank Henwood grew up and failed at several business attempts, then moved to Denver where his friend and business partner Loveland helped him create a life there by connecting him to the city's business leaders. Which is how Henwood met Springer, whom Henwood claimed did the most to help his career. Springer instantly took a liking to him and took him under his wing. In March of 1911, only several months after arriving in Denver, John Springer introduced his wife Isabel to his young mining promoter, Frank Henwood. From this point on, the three were inseparable and were seen all over Denver together, with Sassy always at Henwood's side, though always with her husband, too. Henwood called her Sassy. She called him Frank. The Springers welcomed Henwood into their family and into their home, Castle Isabel, where the three would often go hide out. I'm sitting here trying to figure out how to explain Henwood to you, but the only words coming into my head that fit the bill are cocky little shit. I know we're not supposed to judge books by their cover, but just take a look at his photo, yeah? It explains a lot. And quite literally, too, seeing as his face bore the scars from his drunken brawls, including the one over his right eye that gave him said cocky look. I don't feel too bad about this shit-talking because Henwood wasn't a great guy. Soon after arriving in Denver, 35-year-old Henwood began banging on the door of an actress whose play he'd just seen at 3 in the morning. The drunkard couldn't understand why the woman would not immediately open the door for him. The actress called the hotel, who fined him $7 and kicked him out. And then there was the time he got drunk and beat a defenseless bellboy. He got into fights at the Denver restaurant's Tortoni's and at Navarre, a bar-restaurant brothel all-in-one just across from the Brown Palace Hotel. One Denver woman remembered Henwood. He was the sort of man who quarreled with waiters in cafes. If things didn't exactly suit, he raised a fuss about them and then sent them back and argued with the waiter. And another recalled, "If there was a certain kind of wine that Henwood liked, we must drink it and like it too." Those who really knew him regarded him as mentally unstable, not just for his drinking and fighting, but because he often had to take time off to rest. Crack noted how he had been hospitalized several times, but he also spent long periods of time unemployed in the various cities he lived in at one time or another. New York, Memphis, Seattle, Alaska, British Columbia, Australia, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Boston, Montreal, and Toronto. But even as the trio gallivanted across Denver, Sassy continued to write to her aeronaut lover, Tony Boy, as she called him. Only now, Tony Boy was growing tired of Sassy playing with his emotions, particularly since a third man had entered the picture and taken her attention. We only have one of Von Fool's letters, so we can't be sure of all that he said to her, but it's clear from her response that he was unhappy about the situation. "I am very sorry you feel the way you do, and dear boy, I must assure you, you are wrong, wrong, wrong. I want you to give up that trip and come here in a week and no later. I want you here and you must come. If you do, I will tell you what you will be glad to hear, something I cannot put down here. There are reasons why you should at least postpone your trip, and you will be glad you came." Then, in a classic Sassy move, since she liked reminding her men how adored she was by others, "Frank is still here, and is, of course, still acting naughty. I have quite a surprise in store for you," she wrote. "Something that will please you, I am sure, and the other will be all adjusted as soon as you arrive, and you will be yourself again." Von Fool was unhappy that Frank was in her life, but Henwood was also angry. Angry that even with he and her husband at Sassy's side, she still felt the need to correspond with Tony Von Fool. I have yet to learn how Henwood found out about Von Fool, though he would later argue that it was Isabel who came to him for help. He claimed that Von Fool had begun to threaten Isabel with showing her letters to her husband, and Isabel asked Henwood to intervene and help her retrieve them. Sassy knew her husband's ego, knew life as she knew it would be over if John Springer ever laid eyes on those letters. Henwood forbid Sassy from communicating with Von Fool, and when the aeronaut wrote to her via her maid, she had the letter sent directly to Henwood, unopened. Von Fool's letter read, "If you are too busy to write me a letter, just say so and I won't expect them. I have not heard from you for 3 days. I leave here about the 23rd for Denver. If my father does not die, but I am afraid the old man is in pretty bad condition, and am holding myself in readiness for a quick trip home. The least I expect from you is for you to behave yourself while I am under this terrific strain, and have nothing to do with that double-crosser. No, you don't have to take him out to the ranch or have anything to do with him. Just show him where he gets off, or I will." Just 3 days before Von Fool was due to arrive in Denver, she sent him a telegram. "For God's sake, wire me. I can't stand your silence any longer. I am crazy to see and be with you. You know what my answer will be when you come. Isabel." What answer did Isabel have for Tony? And what was it that he had asked her? Was he using Sassy's letters as blackmail to keep her in line, as Dick Kreck theorized? Von Fool could not have been happy that while she belonged to him and loved him better than anyone else, she was spending all her time with another man. And that man wasn't even her husband. Thirty-three-year-old Sylvester Von Fool, with his blue eyes and pompadour combed over on the left side, arrived at Denver's Union Station on May 23, 1911. Henwood knew he was coming, for Isabel begged for his help in retrieving her letters, now being used as blackmail. Henwood had Isabel write a note to Von Fool for him to read as soon as checking into the hotel. "This is just to let you know that someone knows a great deal. Therefore, under no circumstances telephone me or try to communicate with me in any way. Everything is finally and absolutely off, and if you wish to save yourself serious trouble with someone and his friends, you will forget that you ever knew me. Personally, my future is of too much consequence and I'll never risk it. I will send someone to you to have a final talk with you, and you must be guided by what they say. I have been forbidden to see you or hear from you in the future, and I have given my word, which I propose to keep, not to see you again. I have taken this means of letting you know." Von Fool had already been suspicious that something was going on, and the letter proved it. Frank Henwood was trying to meddle in his relationship with Sassy, and he wasn't having it. The two men finally met in the lobby at around 4:45 when Henwood had a bellboy pull Von Fool out of the hotel's barroom. Henwood explained that he was the man referred to in the letter Von Fool received on arrival and asked if he would meet up with him in his hotel room at 5:30. Tony agreed to the meeting, but then 10 minutes before they were due to meet, Henwood saw Von Fool make his way over to the clerk and then over to the exit. Henwood confronted him. "Well, you're ready for me, aren't you?" "I'll be there," Von Fool responded, and then exited the hotel. It was 5:20 p.m. After the clerk informed Henwood that the man was headed to a department store by the name of Daniels and Fisher, he decided to follow him, not wanting to let him out of sight. When he got to the store, there was no sign of the balloonist, but there was Sassy there, waiting with her mother and another female companion. Henwood confronted Isabel, accusing her of hiding the truth from him and arranging to meet Von Fool in secret when she swore to allow him to speak to Von Fool first for her. Sassy denied doing this. "No, I'm not." But Henwood didn't believe her and said he knew that Von Fool was on his way to meet her. "That is the worst thing you can do," he scolded her. "When you reach a point with a person that is threatening you, the time comes for a showdown. Make him know exactly that you are not going to let him go any further." She denied it again, just as Von Fool strolled up to them, addressing Henwood. "Oh, eavesdropper, you hear? I want to talk to this young lady, alone," he said, locking eyes with Sassy. Henwood told him that he was not to talk to her and that he was interfering to prevent Von Fool from ruining his best friend's marriage. "As a friend of both John and Isabel, I will deal with you for Mrs. Springer." Von Fool looked back at Henwood. "I have a goddamn notion to spill you all over the place." Henwood, too, became aggressive as Isabel and her mother grew upset, so he asked Von Fool to save their conversation for later in private. Tony resented being told what to do and responded with, "You are a damn son of a bitch of an eavesdropper. What in the hell are you butting in for, you son of a bitch?" He had known Sassy for years, and here was this jackass he had just met, ordering him around and forbidding them to speak. Tony wouldn't stand for it. Neither of them wanted to let the other out of his sight, so the two men quarreled their way into a shared taxi back to the Brown Palace, then up to Von Fool's room. As soon as he shut the door, Henwood walked right over and felt on Von Fool's right hip, noting the weapon he carried in his pocket. Von Fool didn't deny having a gun on him, and Henwood replied that he personally did not have a gun because he had never once in his life carried one. "I think a man who does is a coward," he told Von Fool. "I have not come here for trouble. I want to talk with you like a man." So Von Fool walked over to a chair, took a seat, and spoke. "You are an impostor, Mr. Henwood." "I am a very close friend of John Springer," Henwood replied. "He is the one man who made my success in Denver possible. I understand you have some foolish letters of Isabel's. I know her as John's wife, and I have known of this thing for a long time." Mind you, Henwood had only met Isabel 3 months prior at this point. He continued, "You have been threatening to send them, one by one, to her husband unless she left him. I have been with him every day, practically, since I have known him. He has helped me in 1,000 different ways, both socially and in a business way." Tony listened calmly as Henwood explained how John Springer needed his wife, and that his wife equally needed him and was desperate to save their family. "For God's sake, Tony," Henwood pleaded, "will you break up this home?" Henwood's mistake was in calling him Tony. It was all Isabel ever referred to Von Fool as, so Henwood assumed that was what everyone called him. But he was unaware that Tony reserved the nickname for only his closest friends. Everyone else knew never to call him Tony. Upon being called Tony, he stood from his seat and slapped Henwood across the face. Henwood, about 40 pounds lighter than the aviator, stumbled backwards, then righted himself. "Von Fool," Henwood started again, "you are the first man who ever struck me without my returning it. I cannot afford a scene at this hotel. I still want to talk to you." "What do you want to say?" Von Fool retorted, while grabbing a shoe tree lying beside him before raising it and crashing it into Henwood's forehead. The two fell into a scuffle, which ended with Henwood, surprisingly, pinning Von Fool's hands down long enough to beg him once more for a civil conversation. "All right." Henwood got up, walked over to the door, and unlocked it, but when he turned back towards Von Fool, he found a revolver pointed at him, and then pushed into his gut. "You dirty coward! You dare not pull the trigger! You are a coward, a dirty cur!" Von Fool glared at him for a moment, then lowered the gun. "Get out of my room, you son of a bitch. I can't get you here because they would have it on me, but I'll get you yet, and I'll get you quick." Henwood fled back to his room on the 7th floor, and Von Fool marched to Isabel on the 6th floor. "You have lied to me," he yelled, and then struck her across the face, causing her to stagger backwards. She just barely caught herself from falling. And then Von Fool spotted Henwood, though this time it was two framed photographs of him. They were signed, one with, "My bestest to Sassy, who can bring out the best side of anyone I know. Faithfully, Frank." And the other, "John and Sassy, don't. With best wishes from I won't, Frank." Von Fool smashed the glass, ripped the photographs out of their frames, and then tore them to shreds, telling Sassy she shouldn't have photos of such a man. A week prior, Henwood had forced Sassy to rip up Von Fool's photos, and now Von Fool was ripping up Henwood's, and, borrowing some stationery, penned a letter to accompany the shredded photo back to Henwood's room. "Frankie, dear," Tony wrote to him, "you destroyed my picture, and here is part of yours." Before leaving, he told Isabel that if he ever saw Henwood with her again, even in her husband's presence, he would fix him. Tony changed his hotel room to the 6th floor, just by Isabel's, to make sure Henwood wasn't going to visit her. At 6:30 that evening, they all found themselves downstairs in the dining room where Henwood watched at a distance as Von Fool made his way over to Isabel and John Springer and introduced himself to the man he had been cuckolding. "An honor to meet you," John Springer said. Henwood was flustered that his plans were not unraveling the way he wished they would, so he sought out a higher authority, the city's police chief, Hamilton Armstrong. He finally had to explain why he wanted the son of a bitch run out of town, but upon hearing about the love triangle, or love quadrangle, and the powerful man involved at the center of it all, John Springer, the chief was reluctant to use the police force to do anything about the matter. Henwood tried to persuade the chief to intervene and get Von Fool to leave town. "Now, chief, you know what that will mean for him," meaning John Springer, if word about his wife became public. "It will mean John's absolute ruin. I don't know what John will do when he finds this out, but he is absolutely ruined if he takes a step of that kind, and I would almost rather do it myself." The next morning, Isabel rose early and drove with Von Fool and her mother out to their ranch, Castle Isabel. She apparently wanted to calm him down, but it's unknown what occurred while they were there. Regardless, they all returned to the city later that day, and Isabel, seeing that Von Fool was unlikely to back down, realized that she had made a grave mistake in enlisting Henwood to help retrieve her letters. She visited Henwood and asked him to stop. "Please drop this now where you are. For my own sake, for my husband's and my future, you are not dealing with this in the right way." Which was a ridiculous thought to Henwood, who replied, "You are making a mistake. You don't know how to manage such affairs. It takes a man to handle it, man to man. Promise me you won't go near Von Fool. You're making a mistake not calling for a showdown." But Isabel wouldn't promise. She was irate at his ineptitude. The argument worsened when he admitted asking for Chief Armstrong's help. She was horrified that he dare bring her name down to the police station where it might have been logged in official records, not to mention that the chief was a friend of her husband's. So Henwood did what any reasonable person would do and bought himself a .38 caliber pearl-handled Smith & Wesson revolver. That was a joke, in case you didn't catch it. And remember, Henwood was the one who claimed to never have once carried a gun because they were for cowards. But now he claimed his life was being threatened. He had to be ready. Frank Henwood strolled in through the Broadway entrance of the Brown Palace and into the adjoining marble bar room, just after the Follies of 1910 let out. Both Springers and Henwood had seen the play the week earlier, with John Springer's friends even having to hold him inside his box after nearly tumbling out of it, trying to get a closer look at the bathing beauties on stage. This Wednesday evening, May 24th, Just Henwood attended the play as the Springers stayed home. Von Fool also attended, and even knew many in the cast from his time in New York City. The show went on without incident, despite Henwood upsetting one of his acquaintances. Henwood smacked an older judge on the back and told him to have his pick of the ladies on stage, and he would make sure the girl was ready for the judge after the show. The judge was offended, and Henwood later apologized, telling him, "I didn't mean anything, old chap. You just don't understand our free and easy Western ways." The judge replied, "Not your kind of Western ways, I'll admit." But then he told Henwood to just forget it, and they shook hands, returning to the bottle of champagne Henwood just ordered for their party at the Brown Palace's bar. Moments later, Von Fool walked into the Marble Bar with the manager of the Follies Company tour. At the far end of the room, Atkinson and Copeland were just ordering their drinks as Von Fool and the manager Rosenbaum approached the bar. And Von Fool, seeing Henwood and his friends to their right, commented to him, loudly enough for Henwood to hear, "There's that son of a bitch I licked, and I ought to lick him again." Von Fool then asked Rosenbaum to switch places with him, putting him directly beside Henwood. Von Fool then asked the manager if he shouldn't send up a bottle of wine to his wife, who was staying in a room upstairs. Rosenbaum thought it a good idea and went upstairs to check if she were still awake, promising to be right back. With Tony now alone at the bar, Henwood spoke up. Mr. Von Fool, won't you reconsider what happened yesterday afternoon?" Von Fool didn't skip a beat. "I'm going upstairs and I'm going to grab that gray-haired son of a bitch by the hair and pull him out of there and show him who is master here." He was talking about John Springer. "You can't get that over on me," Henwood spat. Behind them, Atkinson was telling Copeland that they should get out of there because it looked like there was going to be a fight. "I will get you first," the balloonist responded, and then punched Henwood in the jaw. Henwood wasn't ready for it, and he flew backward so suddenly that he landed on the ground, butt first, followed by his head, which slammed into the marble floor. In pain and humiliated, Henwood rocked forward, kneeling on one knee, and shoved his hand into his pocket, reaching for the revolver that kept catching on the fabric. "He's going to shoot!" someone in the crowd yelled. Von Fool had meanwhile turned back to the bar when Henwood began shooting. As bullets sprayed the room, the men scrambled for safety, with Atkinson and Copeland trying to reach the exit into the hotel lobby, and about 20 others inside the bar fleeing for the street exit. The first bullet struck Von Fool in the shoulder. Realizing he was being shot at, he crouched down along the bar as he made his way to the exit. Two bullets meant for him sailed into George Copeland's right hip and left thigh. A second bullet entered, then exited through Von Fool's right wrist as he lifted it in the air. The bullet continued through to Atkinson's left thigh and shattered his femur. "My God!" Atkinson screamed. "I'm shot!" He hobbled several steps and then collapsed near the lobby. Henwood pulled the trigger a fifth and final time. This bullet traveled between Von Fool's 11th and 12th ribs. The bullet moved upward through his stomach and then nestled itself under the skin of his abdomen. He was almost to the exit. Henwood continued to pull the trigger, but was only met with a metallic clicking sound. Elevator operator Frank Canfield wrenched the gun from Henwood's hand and placed it on the bar for the bartender to lock away in a drawer behind the counter. Von Fool staggered into the lobby and collapsed in an armchair beside the door. He was using his left hand to raise his right arm in the air as blood trickled out of his wrist and down his shirt. Bystanders rushed to help stop the bleeding by placing their handkerchief over the wound and reaching into Von Fool's pocket to grab his handkerchief for the other bullet holes. They felt no gun on him. The aeronaut told him, "Get a doctor quickly. I'm very badly hurt." Back in the marble bar, Henwood turned to face the wreckage after having the gun snatched from him, and through the smoke-filled bar, he spotted his unintended victims. Henwood was strangely calm. He picked up his straw hat, which had fallen off his head after hitting the floor, placed it back on his head, and walked over to Atkinson, who lay on the floor with a cigar still clenched between his teeth. "I'm sorry I shot you. Can I help you?" Atkinson was aghast. "You've done enough already. Get out and leave me alone, you son of a bitch." Copeland lay on the floor behind him until someone helped him to an anteroom near the bar. The shots were heard as far as 2 blocks away, and the police were already on the way, even if the hotel had not already called them. Atkinson's friends stayed with him as he continued to smoke his cigar on the floor before both he and Copeland were transported, still alive, to St. Luke's Hospital. Back in the lobby, Von Fool was assuring everyone that he was okay and that someone should wire his family in St. Louis to tell them not to believe what they read in the papers and that he would be fine. He had been shot in the shoulder, wrist, and abdomen, and he said he just wanted to go back up to his hotel room. "I don't think I'm seriously injured," he said, but the doctors urged him to get into the ambulance and go to the hospital. "Get me in a taxi cab if you're bound to take me to the hospital. I don't think it's worthwhile going. Why can't I go to my room, doctor?" The doc explained that a hotel room is no place for a man who had just been shot 3 times. "It's good enough for me," Von Fool replied, then tried to stand. His friends caught him and tried to stop him, but he yelled at them and told him to leave him alone. "Be reasonable, Tony." "I am reasonable. Who's got my watch? I want that watch, and I want everything else that belongs to me." "You've got everything, Tony." When they got him out to the street, he refused the ambulance and took a taxi to the hospital. Henwood stayed put and made no attempt to flee. In fact, upon seeing how badly injured Copeland and Atkinson were, and just how badly he had overreacted, Henwood burst into tears. "I did it! I was attacked." He wasn't even talking to anyone specifically. He just wanted to let everyone there know. "I didn't mean to do it. Oh, just let me touch him. I didn't mean to do it." A policeman entered the Brown Palace and held him there until detectives and Chief Armstrong arrived and took him into custody. He later told the chief, whom he visited the day prior, begging him to run Von Fool out of town, "We had a few words while standing at the bar. His attitude angered me, and I may have used strong language. He struck me, and I protected myself with my revolver. I am sorry that 2 innocent persons were injured. I did not intend to hurt anyone but Von Fool, and I have no regret for injuring him, nor will I ever have." Henwood claimed that Von Fool was looking for trouble, and he found it. "I never carried a gun in my life until tonight, but I was told that Von Fool always carried weapons and was a bad man, and I thought I would take steps to protect myself." Now, in the wake of the shooting, both Henwood and Von Fool threw out crazy lies about what had happened at the bar and what prompted the shooting. This is because neither one of them wanted the truth out. Neither wanted the public knowing that the shooting had been over a woman. First, because it made them look bad, but second, because it was like the #1 rule of a gentleman. Never bring a lady's name into public affairs. Von Fool's nephew later told the papers that the balloonist advised him, "Never mention a woman's name in such an affair." In 1911, a woman's name was sacred, and it was a man's duty to protect it for her, particularly that of a socialite like Isabel married to such a public man like John Springer. So, first, Henwood claimed the fight was over Von Fool being rude and sticking his finger in his glass of wine. Then, he claimed it was over a bathing beauty scene from the Follies of 1910. Von Fool, in the hospital, remained mute about the woman at the heart of the scandal. Copeland was expected to recover, though he was in tremendous pain from the hip wound and wasn't getting much sleep. Atkinson had an operation to remove the bullet in his leg and then was declared wholly out of danger, though it would be years before he would walk okay. Von Pfuhl got worse news when he asked the doctor how bad his wounds were. Fatal. "How long will I live?" he asked. "Oh, I think until about noon." Sylvester von Pfuhl had been at death's door many times before, but now death was certain, and it was coming for him in only hours. "Well, I always said I would never get killed ballooning, and this settles that." He called for a priest whom he was able to confess the full truth to, but kept quiet about Isabel to everyone else. The closest he got was when he told a nurse, "I hold no grudge against Henwood. He was a good sport, but I didn't think he'd let a woman come between us. He insulted me, and I knocked him down just as I would any cur. I did not for a moment think he would shoot. Then he got up and started shooting. The coward fired 5 shots at me while I stood there helpless. The first bullet entered my right shoulder and left me completely at the mercy of the dog." His cousin visited him in the hospital. "My God, Tony, what was the trouble? Was it that woman?" "For God's sake, don't talk about it. Can't you see I'm a goner?" As time passed, he became more incoherent. He took pleasure in talking about his ballooning adventures until he was too weak to talk. Chief Armstrong and the deputy district attorney arrived at the hospital to take Von Pfuhl's statement at about 10 a.m., but were told to wait until his doctor returned. When he did, at around 11:20, and allowed them in to see Tony, the nurse was walking out as they were going in. "He's dead," she said. It had been 12 hours since the shooting. Upon hearing the news, Henwood, in his cell, had a nervous breakdown. According to historian Dick Crack, he pleaded last night that he be removed to the county hospital, as he said he did not want to take a chance of becoming a nervous wreck and thus endangering his chances for a defense. They didn't allow it. The following day, Copeland's wife arrived to be with him at St. Luke's Hospital. A local paper reported that Copeland will recover in a short time, the physicians at St. Luke's state, unless unforeseen complications set in. The doctors were most concerned about the hip wound and were relieved when they were able to remove the bullet and his condition began to improve. Yet, several days later, the doctors noticed he developed gangrene around the wound on his leg. They believe the best course of action was to amputate, so they sent him into surgery. George Copeland died after the amputation on June 1st due to shock and blood loss. He was only 38 years old. When the warden told Henwood he would be facing a second murder charge, he lost his mind, wailing and flinging himself on the bed. He refused to eat and kept repeating, "I'll go mad." Henwood had been quite friendly with the reporters earlier, but now he said he wouldn't talk to them. "I can't talk to you. I can't think since I heard of Copeland's death. I can't talk. I shall go mad." Henwood had been running his mouth about the event, though still not bringing Isabel's name into the matter, but telling everyone that Von Pfuhl had been the aggressor and he was simply protecting himself. Henry Von Pfuhl, the balloonist's cousin and former sheriff, spoke up. "It was a cowardly murder, and I find only one solace, and that was that Tony died game. The man who shot him is a coward. He has been found out in this respect before. He was in the habit of beating waiters who could not resist, and when he ran up against a man he could not bully, he had to get a gun and shoot him in a dastardly manner."
Not evil-minded, ma'am. We'll keep you evil-minded.
Despite the men's efforts to keep Sassy's name from the papers, Reporters speculated early on that the shooting was over a society lady, but it only took several days before Isabel Springer and her photograph were included in the newspaper coverage that spanned the country. John Springer filed for divorce after reading for himself the 8 letters found in Von Fuhl's hotel room at the Brown Palace. His ego shattered, he refused to speak to or see Isabel, who fled to Chicago once her name went public. She also feared being called on for Henwood's trial, but would later be subpoenaed anyway. The press found her in Chicago, sporting newly dyed white hair. She apparently thought it would make a good disguise for her, but it didn't. When her attorney advised her to return to Denver to try and work things out with her husband, she took a train back, but he still refused to see her. According to the Rocky Mountain News, "We have been unable to get Mr. Springer to meet Mrs. Springer. He cannot be found. It is quite evident that he does not wish to see her. It seems that he disappeared off the face of the earth after being humiliated and heartbroken by Isabel in such a public way, and it would be some time before he would reappear in public." When Sassy found that John would not see her, she became ill and secluded herself in her room at the Hotel Savoy. John Springer's position in society meant that he had some influence over what the papers printed, even if they did still insist on printing his name. Springer was a city leader, and few in Denver wanted to further drag his name through the mud, much as they might have liked reading all the gossip. Henwood was in his cell, insisting that the shooting was an act of brotherhood and friendship. The Rocky Mountain News wrote, "But his dominant thoughts were not of the stern ordeal of the law which he must face, or the prison stripes he may wear, or the hard prison labor he may undergo. You will see," he said, with the earnest light of friendship shining from his eyes, "that you have made a mistake in printing my dearest friend's name." The prosecutor, Elliot, chose to seek a first-degree murder conviction for Copeland's death rather than Von Fuhl. People speculated this was to keep the Springers out of the paper, but her name was out there after several days anyway. Elliot guessed that he would be more likely to win by charging Henwood for Copeland's death, since Copeland was just an innocent bystander with no connection to the drama at all. Henwood, though, would likely claim he was just trying to preserve the honor of his best friend if he tried him for Von Fuhl's murder, and the prosecutor worried that this would make the jury sympathize with him, which he did not want. When the trial began, it sought to answer 2 main questions. Of course, beyond the main one, which was, should they hold Henwood responsible for Copeland's death? The first question was Henwood so threatened by Von Fuhl that he was justified in using a gun to protect himself? And the second, did Von Fuhl have his back turned to Henwood when he was first shot? Henwood was adamant that Von Fuhl was facing him when he took the gun from his pocket and began firing. One of the few people to agree with him was a bellboy at the hotel, who testified that Von Fuhl had his left hand on the bar, quote, "with a sneer on his face, looking down at Henwood and with his right hand on his hip in this position," end quote. The defense was arguing that Henwood feared Von Fuhl had his gun on him, and with his right hand on his hip, he very well could have been reaching for his firearm. But the prosecution had witnesses to tell otherwise. A bank cashier said that Von Fuhl had turned back and was facing the bar, and made no motion to get a gun. Von Fuhl turned after Henwood struck the floor almost simultaneously, he said. And then Henwood. Well, he sprang up very quickly. He seemed nervous and started to pull the pistol from his pocket. He could not get it very quick. There was something holding it down in his pocket. Then Bank President Charles Schilling spoke. Mr. Henwood jumped to his feet, threw his coat back, and I saw the gun drawn. Schilling specified that Henwood was only about 4 or 5 feet away from Von Fool at this point. The attorney asked if Von Fool made any movement towards Henwood. "Not that I saw, except that he struck him." "After?" "No, sir." Then there was Judge James Owen, who specified, "Mr. Von Fool turned back to the bar and remained in that position with his right side toward me and facing the bar. Mr. Henwood commenced to shoot, and Mr. Von Fool started to go out of the room, and he threw up his hand while the bullets were still being fired." The prosecution also wanted to remind the jury that they had physical evidence to attest to this. The bullet that entered through the back of Von Fool's shoulder. The defense was quick to point out that, yeah, sure, he was hit in the back, but who's to say which bullet that was? It could have been that Von Fool was hit by another bullet first and then turned his back to Henwood afterward when trying to flee. Henwood took the stand to explain what happened himself. He had become quite the character, by the way, being followed around everywhere by the courthouse dog, and having crowds of women line up to see him in court most days. Papers noted all the women craning their necks to see him arrive and crowding the back entrance when he went to leave for the day. "That's he! Oh my!" they would say. Despite all his faults, he was a dapper-looking fellow. Not everyone was impressed, though. One spectator was overheard saying, "I think he could have handled Von Fool without a revolver." Henwood testified that Von Fool was a dangerous man who threatened his life several times over, telling Isabel he would fix him. He tried to have a civil conversation with him in the bar that night, but was punched in the jaw instead. "I got up, and as I lifted myself, there was only one thought in my mind. That was to see that man reach for a gun. I was almost certain that I did see him put his hand on his right hip. It was simply a movement on my part to protect myself." He hoped the explanation was enough to save him. Unfortunately for him, Sassy herself was called to the stand. Henwood thought it was a blessing at first, since it was Isabel who asked him to intervene in the first place to help her retrieve her letters. But what Isabel told the jury was that, yes, she had originally asked for Henwood's help, but then she pleaded with him to stay out of it because he was only making things worse. "I feared there would be trouble if he did not stop right where he was." Sassy wasn't helping Henwood. She was calling him a meddler. "I told him to please let me do it myself, that was the only way to avoid trouble." "He acted without your authority and advice?" the attorney asked.
"Yes, sir."
"She asked him not to. For my sake, for my husband's sake, and for the sake of my home. You told him you could manage your own affairs, did you not?"
"Yes."
Isabel denied that Von Fool ever threatened to kill Henwood, but she did admit that Von Fool was abusive toward her. She related him striking her across the face in her hotel room after Henwood confronted him, and that he had struck her before, too, 3 different times. But by the end of the day, spectators were disappointed. They expected all the salacious details with Sassy on the stand, but the attorneys had carefully crafted questions that kept her from revealing too much. The papers noted, "Some powerful influence," blocked all the most dangerous questions from being asked. They did get a little gossip, however, when Henwood was being cross-examined and forced to admit that he actually had a wife and 2 children, which was a shock to them all. When asked where his wife and kids were, Henwood explained that they were in New York, but where specifically in the state, he couldn't say. The trial became even more scandalous the following day when Isabel's maid testified. Cora Carpenter was working for Sassy when she took a trip to Castle Isabel with Henwood. John was to join them in several days, but for the time being, the two had the ranch to themselves, and a few of their attendants. She recalled a procession of whiskey glasses that were sent up to Isabel's room. Sassy had fallen from her horse earlier in the day, so Henwood had gone up to check on her, and then never came down. The lawyer questioning her wanted to know how she knew the couple had actually drank all the whiskey sent to them, and she replied, "Because I washed the glasses and there was nothing in them." She told the jury that the room Henwood stayed in was actually connected to Isabel's by a small bathroom in the middle. When Cora Carpenter went upstairs the next morning, it had been clear to her that the two slept together, for only Isabel's bed had been slept in. Henwood's bed was untouched. Henwood became noticeably flustered during her testimony, particularly when she related the story about Sassy's nightgown. The maid left Isabel's nightgown freshly ironed in her closet the night before, but the morning following her and Henwood's whiskey procession, the maid found it torn into strips in front and about the neck. And then there was the time she walked in on the two of them embracing. Henwood was seated with his hands around Sassy's hips. She was standing in front of him with her hand on his shoulders. The Springer's chauffeur also caught them in an intimate moment when he looked behind him to check for cars while driving and spotted their heads pressed together with his arm around Isabel. When Isabel saw the chauffeur turn, she quickly pushed Henwood off her. The district attorney pounced on this. "I'll tell you what Henwood was acting under. He had illicit relations with Mrs. Springer, and he knew it. And he feared that Von Fool stood higher in the affections of this lady than he did." The judge, a friend of Springer's, by the way, described the jury's options for a verdict and told them there would be no option of manslaughter. The jurors had to believe Henwood honestly and in good faith believed his life was in danger, and not in a spirit of revenge or jealousy. The jury could find Henwood guilty in the first or second degree, or they could find him not guilty. Henwood was cool as a cucumber as the jury went into deliberation. He watched the jurors walking back into court after saying they had a verdict, and found a few of them smiling and joking. This put him at ease, thinking they wouldn't be so happy-looking if they were about to send a man away for life or death. His lip quivered when the judge read out the verdict in court. Guilty of second-degree murder. 2 days later, John Springer's divorce to Isabel was granted, ending their 4-year marriage. Henwood did not take the verdict gracefully. At his sentencing hearing, he went on a long diatribe against the judge, accusing him of favoring the prosecution and reminding everyone of his reputation as a prejudiced judge, eager to prosecute. And, again, argued the shooting was all in self-defense. The judge's response was this: "I believe from what you have said that you shot purposefully and with the intention of killing Von Fool. I believe that you did it out of jealousy and revenge, excited by the passion that you entertained for the Springer woman, and that you shot to put Von Fool out of the way, that you got your gun for that purpose. That being the case, the court being so advised, ought to perform the maximum penalty under the law. In this case, the judgment of the court is that you be confined in the penitentiary at Kenyon City for and during your natural life." The conviction followed a series of appeals over the following years. His new lawyer, John Bottom, counted a total of 91 errors in the first trial, arguing mostly that the judge was preferential to the prosecution and blocked most of the evidence that would have allowed Henwood to make his case. And the greatest error, not allowing for a verdict of manslaughter. In 1913, the state Supreme Court agreed the judge had erred in doing so and granted him a new trial. Henwood was not doing so hot in jail. He was losing much of his charm and growing cranky. He started a fight with the prison guard in 1912 after he refused to let him use the phone, an amenity that he had grown accustomed to. The second trial featured two new witnesses, which brought attention back to the case. The first was the third victim of the shooting, the elderly Colorado Springs businessman who had been shot in the femur, James Atkinson. In one of the case's funnier moments, Atkinson scared the living bejesus out of the court. Even though he was older, he was still a big guy with shockingly white hair, and due to the accident, had to hobble all his way around on crutches. Atkinson's huge figure suddenly appeared in the courtroom doorway, just as a bolt of lightning struck the sky and illuminated him, in his white suit and white hair hobbling in on his crutches. It was mildly terrifying. Atkinson was still angry at being shot in the leg. I would be too. And he told the court that Von Fool turned back towards the bar, and then Henwood began shooting. And then the moment Henwood had been waiting for, John Springer entered the court to testify on his behalf, claiming that Mr. Henwood was always a gentleman. When he finished, Springer walked over to Henwood and placed his hand on his shoulder while holding out the other for him to shake. "Hello, Frank. How are you, old fellow?" Henwood began to cry, then stood to shake Springer's hand. "Pretty well, thank you, John. And thank you, John." Ass kisser. Just 2 weeks before he was due to be executed, Governor Elias Ammons commuted his sentence from hanging to a life in prison. During his sentence, Henwood lost his good looks. His face became gaunt and aged, particularly with his head shaved, and his mental health worsened. He continued to attack other people, and his paranoia was getting the best of him. People wondered if he was acting crazy just to get out of the death sentence, but he was actually just going crazy. In 1922, Governor Oliver Shoup granted Henwood clemency, and he moved to New Mexico as Francis Collins. Things were starting to look up for him. He became assistant manager of a hotel, but then he threatened to kill a woman because she wouldn't marry him, which was a violation of his parole. He was taken back to prison, where he died at the age of 52 on September 27, 1929, from acute dilation of the heart. John Springer remarried in 1915 and acted like he never even had a second wife by the name of Isabel. He sold the ranch called Castle Isabel in 1913, though his daughter would later own it briefly before selling it herself. He died in 1945 at the age of 85. And Sassy? Several hours after her divorce was finalized, she left Denver with her brother Arthur Patterson, never to return. She spent 2 years in Chicago and then went to New York in 1913, eager to pave her own way as an actress. John Springer settled her with $5,000, though she asked for $25,000. She was allowed to keep her jewelry, diamonds, her favorite car, and Springer's name, and she, in return, swore to never return to Denver. But by 1913, her bad habits had caught up to her. The first time Isabel testified at the trial, everyone commented on her strange behavior. She was very out of it and slow to answer questions, if she did at all, and everyone couldn't help but speculate she had been drugged for the occasion. Particularly when she appeared for a second day of court, much more lucid and put together. It wasn't just Sassy, though. It was a problem of the times. Historians estimated there were 300,000 addicts in New York City in 1917, and in Denver there were about 5,000 hooked on cocaine and morphine. Quote, it was an environment where prescriptions for morphine were available for 50 cents before 6 p.m. and 75 cents before midnight. Men had long been going out on the town and drinking their blues away, but women, who were supposed to stay in the home and out of rowdy public places, did not have going out to drink as an outlet. What they had were doctors who knew little of what life was actually like for a woman, and an eagerness to prescribe them drugs to subdue any uppity behavior. Women, often stuck in the home, began using opium and morphine at alarming rates. Historian H. Wayne Morgan wrote, "An entire industry supplied nerve tonics, blood builders, sedatives, and bromides for women." And Isabel, with all of the abusive men in her life, had turned to such drugs to help her cope. Sassy had used drugs during her marriage and might have been either the cause or effect of the health issues she was having prior to the scandal. People commented on how it seemed as though both Sassy and Henwood had used morphine together in the past, and by the time she arrived in New York City, hoping to rescue her own life by beginning a career as an actress, she seems to have been completely dependent upon them. Audrey Munson, considered America's first supermodel and the inspiration for statues across the city, became friends with Sassy during this part of her life and commented on how she was having a hard time finding work. She sought work in respectable studios as a model for the nude. Here and there, an artist took pity upon the fallen woman and engaged her, but none found her satisfactory because the woman who uses opium cannot hold a pose with necessary firmness. In 1917, Sassy's health began to fail and she had no money to pay her medical bills. It seems as though her family had given her up at this point, for she wound up at the Metropolitan Hospital on Blackwell's Island, now Roosevelt Island in New York City, where she died alone with only one actress friend by her side. She was only 31. Her cause of death was cirrhosis of the liver. Munson relates, "In her meager effects strewn about the sordid rooming house, there was nothing that could be sold for enough to provide even a casket for the potter's field. Sassy was even forced to sell her car back to Springer years earlier because she needed the money, and by the time she died, she was destitute. None of her family or John Springer cared that Sassy's body would go unclaimed, so some of her theater friends chipped in for her to be buried at New Jersey's Fairview Cemetery." A Denver newspaper commented on her death, calling it "the wages of sin." They wrote, "Her fame had departed, her beauty was no more. She had wasted her natural endowments in riotous living. The story is as old as original sin. She was a vampire, an outcast that could not from that time forward reach the fringes of society. She was a haunted woman. The ascent to Avernus is steep, we are told, and there is no room for a woman to turn back. Down, down it must be. The wages of sin is death." They definitely needed the Barbie movie in 1917. Because not everyone in society pays the same tolls for the same sins. Just after he was shot, police searched Von Fuhl's pockets and found, along with Henwood's torn-up photos, a leather address book. It was filled with the names of society women, many of them with the title MRS, Mrs. And the Brown Palace itself boasted a secret tunnel that led to a brothel directly across the street. The Brown had an annex built directly across the street, and they installed a tunnel connecting the two underneath so that the employees could move about more easily. But then it was used by the hotel's prominent guests who didn't want to be seen crossing the street to engage a prostitute. Denver, along with the rest of the country, was beginning an era of progressive reform. There had been a series of domestic disputes in the city, and Dick Crack described Denver as a city struggling to cleanse itself of sin. Denver's era of reform was aimed at precisely the type of woman as Sassy. Had Sassy been a man, she wouldn't have needed to rely on men for financial stability. She would not have been cornered into a marriage with an abusive alcoholic. She would have had the opportunity to choose a partner for herself on her own terms. Had Sassy been a man, no one would bat an eye at her extramarital affair. No one would care. For men, it's the norm. Just take the secret tunnel to the brothel and no one will see you. Henwood went around casually offering prostitutes to respected men of the law, and even when someone got upset at this, all Henwood had to do was offer the guy an apology and some booze and all was forgiven. No wages of death for Henwood's sins. Von Fool had a pocket full of married women he had been romantic with, but there was no scandal in this. No one wanted to know the names of those he slept with. No one cared, because he was a man. He did as he pleased. Sassy was no man, and she was not able to do as she pleased. When she dared to, it ended in a double murder at the Brown Palace Hotel, and every single finger was pointed at her, the society vamp, the infamous fallen woman. This is what happens to women who sin, the papers said. This is what happens when women don't fit the mold and do as they're told. And just like that, a woman's entire life is erased and rewritten as a tragedy. She wasn't a tragedy, though. She was a human being. After Isabel's death, one female reporter wanted to make sure the paper knew Sassy's true character. Mrs. Springer was very pretty and, oh, so feminine. She had charm. She was never heard to say disagreeable things about anybody. She had the smartest turnouts in town. She wore the most stunning frocks. Her hats were miracles, and her dinners provided the finest wine the palate could desire. Mrs. Springer was tender and gentle and very, very sympathetic. Her tips to servants were the talk of the hotel. Sometimes Mrs. Springer stormed and raved, but then a lady must occasionally prove her temperament is not dulled, even by marriage. Whatever her flaws and mistakes, Isabel had a right to seek happiness just as much as Springer, Von Fool, and Henwood did. And instead of pointing fingers at the woman who was trying to get everyone to calm the fuck down and preserve peace, perhaps the villains of the story should be the violent and testosterone-fueled men who could not keep their hands to themselves and opened fire in a crowded barroom. The first love quadrangle of our show, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back in 3 weeks with episode 47, so don't miss it. A complete list of our sources can be found in the show notes or on oldbloodpodcast.com. Visit our Instagram by searching for Old Blood Podcast to see all of the extra photos and documents related to the case. Be sure to leave us a nice review. And music credits to Facilian Studios.